Good morning. I hope you are having a wonderful day. We're going to continue on talking about intermolecular forces, and on Monday, despite projector problems to the nth degree, we did get through most of them anyway, and I want to just do a quick review as to what they are. The weakest of all the intermolecular forces, which are the forces that keep molecules together. They don't hold the molecules internally together, but they help keep like the molecules, and we'll see that helps lead to solid formation, liquids, etc., etc. But the weakest of all of them is, here it's described as dispersion. Another name is London dispersion, but I'll usually refer to them as induced dipole. They all mean the same thing, and they're all four nonpolar molecules. So iodine as a solid, bromine as a liquid, etc. Now, dipole-induced dipole is when you have something nonpolar in something polar. And oxygen in water is a classic example of this. Oxygen is nonpolar by nature, and usually nonpolar things don't wish to go into polar solvents. But water is able to induce a dipole in oxygen where one wasn't existing before. And this is important because the little fish and stuff need oxygen just like you and I need it. So dipole-induced dipole is what gets the oxygen into the water. Then we go through a dipole-dipole group, which is when polar pieces come together. And the intermolecular force that holds the polar pieces together is responsible for making liquids and stuff. Dipole-dipole is the normal version. And as we talked about too, hydrogen bonding is dipole-dipole on steroids. It's a more powerful version of a dipole-dipole force. Hydrogen bonding is only for when you have a hydrogen connected to nitrogen, oxygen, or fluorine. If hydrogen's connected to carbon or chlorine, no hydrogen bonding. And then ion dipole is the last one that we looked at on Monday. Ion dipole involves something ionic, something with a charge. That could be like sodium ions, chloride ions, stuff like that. And they're into something polar. So traditionally that would be water. So sodium chlorides in water, a salt solution, that would be an ion dipole force. The ions come from the sodium or the chloride ions, and the dipole again is from water. Now there's one more force that's actually stronger than all of these, and we're going to collectively call it the ion-ion slash metallic force. In lab yesterday, if you had lab, or in lab today or tomorrow, we'll look more at this force. That's actually stronger than all of these. That's for when you have like solid sodium chloride or sodium metal, stuff like that. Those are actually the most intense forces of all. But most of the time, these are the ones we're going to focus on. I'm just bringing this up there to see. Any questions on these? So here's an example of a type of a problem you might see where we're taking potassium chloride and we're placing it in water. And potassium chloride dissolves really well in water. And we want to know what kinds of IM or intermolecular forces are formed. So, is water something that is polar or nonpolar? Polar, absolutely. It's even hydrogen bonded, although that's not very relevant here. And of the terms used for IM forces, what do we refer to when we have something that's polar? Dipole, that's right, yeah. So for these intermolecular forces, you won't see the term polar per se, but you will see a lot of references to dipoles. So again, every time you see dipole, just think of that again as a polar substance. Now, KCl is dissolving in water. How would you describe KCl's bonding? Ionic. Absolutely. Positive metal, negative non-metal coming together. That's the classic positive-negative super strong interaction. And water is able to squeeze themselves in between there. So we have something ionic in something with a dipole. That's going to be the ion-dipole force. Dipole-dipole would be for when you have polar substances. So, for example, acetone would be dipole-dipole. Hydrogen bonding would be for things like water or ammonia, things that have the NH, the OH, or the FH bond. dipole induced dipole, something polar with something nonpolar. The oxygen dissolving in the water I talked about earlier, or iodine and methanol, and the IDID/London dispersion/dispersion force, that's the nonpolar. So like making it, gasoline technically is an induced dipole in a molecular force. Questions? All right, so now we're going to use our knowledge of these intermolecular forces to start understanding what's happening with liquids. How do liquids turn into gases? How do liquids turn into solids? And along the way, we'll see some kind of interesting things here, too. Well, interesting to me, anyway. So liquids are the crux usually between gases and solids. You lower the temperature to get to solids, and you raise the temperature to get to gases. So in the gases, you have molecules constantly moving. You've got pretty strong intermolecular forces like dipole-dipole if it's polar, or even induced dipole can be large. Molecules are usually closer together than they are in gases, but they are almost incompressible. It's hard to squeeze them anymore. You can squeeze gases pretty hard, but you can't really do it for liquids. And liquids also, unlike gases, don't fill the container. You pour them in, they'll go to the bottom. They don't usually go to the top.
According to the kinetic molecular theory, the molecules of a solid are locked in place, though they have motion. Molecules of a liquid are closely associated with each other, but move relative to one another. Molecules of a gas move independently and occupy a much larger volume than those of a corresponding liquid or solid.
In Chem 222 and Chem 223, we're going to assume that the intermolecular forces on gas are so weak that they don't have any intermolecular forces. So if I said, what's the intermolecular force working on gaseous water, the gas alone should tell you no intermolecular forces working on the gas. It could be gaseous sodium chloride, gaseous gasoline. Gases of all types, we're going to say, won't have any intermolecular forces. It's only the liquids and definitely the solids which have these forces keeping them together. Now, turning liquids into gas and gases back into liquids is something you've probably done even this morning. If you heated up breakfast at all, it probably got warm and some of the molecules turned into gas. But you don't want to keep them necessarily as gas. Sometimes it's nice to break it down. So evaporation and condensation are two terms we use both in our day-to-day lives and also in science. Evaporation means turning a liquid into a gas. And condensation means turning a gas back into a liquid, all right? But now that we know about intermolecular forces, we can think about the energy of these processes. And in physical science, we always want to know how much energy it's going to take, are we going to get energy out, blah, blah, blah. Liquids have lots of intermolecular forces. Gases have no intermolecular forces. So to go from a liquid, where the gases are actually connected to each other, to a gas, you have to break those intermolecular forces. And anytime you break forces apart, you're going to need energy. So there are, to the best of my knowledge, no exceptions of taking a liquid and turning it into a gas that aren't endothermic, that don't require energy. Making a liquid go into a gas, regardless of what it is always going to be endothermic. You have to add energy. But in thermodynamics, if one way is endothermic, the opposite way is exothermic. So when the gases settle down and they want to make liquids again, they're actually going to release energy. It's going to be an exothermic process. So you take your gasoline vapors and you condense it down to gaseous liquid gasoline. That's actually going to be an example of an exothermic. So evaporation is always endothermic. It's going to take energy to do it. It'll have a positive enthalpy, these kind of terms. But condensation, going from gases back to liquids, exothermic energy will be released. And I know of no exceptions to this rule, which is always kind of interesting. Now, liquids have another interesting thing about them. If you have to add energy to turn them into gases, and you release energy turning the gases back into liquids, there's some interesting properties that start to happen. Again, making them go from the liquid to the gas is going to take energy. So evaporation and endothermic will go together. But condensation, the opposite process, gases back to liquids, that's always going to be exothermic. You'll get energy out.
Molecules of a liquid have a range of kinetic energies, some have enough energy to overcome intermolecular forces. If these high energy molecules are at the surface of the liquid, they can escape into the gas phase. This is an endothermic process.
Liquid water doesn't turn into a gas without applying energy to it, like on a stovetop, all right? So that's what you need to have happen. But notice that in this example, we have an open flask container, like a beaker, all right? And if you add enough energy, you keep sending the liquid molecules into the gas state. Gases keep expanding. What's going to happen to your liquid after a while? It's gone. Yeah, it's going to go away and stuff. If you're at the ocean and it's warm, unlike today. Okay, prop that back on. If you're in a nice warm place and you leave water out, it's going to evaporate. You'll be left with stuff at the bottom maybe. So all of these things, if you really want to make it go back, you have to have some way to control the gas. This is the joy of working with gases. Now, just like with gases, there's always going to be an average energy per molecule. And as the temperatures get warmer, you're going to have more molecules at a higher energy. So the blue line here is a lower temperature, and the higher red line here is the higher temperature. So you can imagine this might be water. Maybe this is 30 degrees, and maybe the red line here for water would be like 100 degrees. Now, in terms of liquids, this line right here is that minimum energy required to make the intermolecular forces break apart and evaporation begins to occur. So notice here that if this line is like 30 degrees, there's not many molecules with enough energy to evaporate, all right? So most of your bulk liquid will be there. On the other hand, if you leave your liquid out long enough and it's dry outside, you're going to start to have more and more molecules go over here and your population will go down. But generally speaking, most of the liquid will stay the liquid at this temperature. But when you raise the temperature up, now your average energy per molecule is much larger. And if you get enough molecules past that dotted line where evaporation begins to occur, you're going to start having liquid molecules go to the gas phase. Now, not all of the molecules will have enough energy. So when you get water to the boiling part on your stove, it's not like, you know, all of a sudden it starts to boil and the water's gone, all right? You see the stuff bubble, it starts to bubble, and you know, oh yeah, cool, it's boiling, but it doesn't just go away like that. That's because only some of the molecules have enough energy to boil. A lot of the molecules still need to gain enough energy to have it happen. So again, like we talked about the freeway, and there's fast drivers and slow drivers, all right? Even at boiling water temperatures, all right, you're going to have a lot more fast drivers able to turn into a gas, but not all of them will. The same thing happens for freezing, all right? If you take liquid water and you put it in the freezer and stuff and you slowly cool it down at 0 degrees Celsius, you will start to see some of the liquid turn to gas, but it doesn't all, bam, turn into ice instantly. That would be kind of cool if it would flash freeze or something, but anyway, it's kind of a slow process, all right? You have to have the molecules gain energy in terms of boiling or lose energy in terms of freezing. So the punchline of this slide here is that boiling doesn't mean, bam, it's all gas, all right? I want to dispel that right now because that's a really hard thing at first sometimes to get rid of. It's a process. You begin the process of turning your liquid into gas at the boiling temperature. But until these other parts down here have enough energy, it's not all going to just instantly go away. Kinetic energy of the molecule is proportional to the temperature, all right? So as temperature goes up, the kinetic energy goes up. So the red line is much more to the right than the blue line. Red line means higher energy. At a higher temperature, you have more and more molecules able to get into the gas phase. That means that they've got enough energy to break their intermolecular forces. So for water, it would be breaking the hydrogen bond forces. For acetone, it would be breaking dipole-dipole. For gasoline, you'd have to break the induced dipole-induced dipole forces. So that's what happens, and it's a slow process. It doesn't all happen like instantaneously, at least not usually. Now, this is an example of a closed flask system. So instead of letting the water all boil away and we have to do something else, we're going to keep a cap on this particular system. And what's really interesting about liquids is that at any temperature, from that blue cold line to the red warm line, some of the molecules are going to have enough energy to go into the gas phase. So if you put a cap on this thing, you're going to have some molecules in the gas phase and some molecules in the liquid phase. And anytime you have molecules in the gas phase, that's a gas. And gases have pressure. So a vapor pressure is the pressure that exists over all liquids. It's easier to detect when it's a closed system, but it also works on open systems as well. Some of those liquid molecules just aren't happy being liquids, so they're going to move into the gas phase. So almost all liquids have a vapor pressure over them. And that's just a few of the molecules with enough energy to turn it into a gas. If you put a cap on it like that, you get to what's called the equilibrium vapor pressure, because now you've got time for the molecules to build up their evaporation, which is liquid to gas, and condensation. Some of these molecules say, I want to go home, I want to be a liquid again. So they return back to the liquid phase. If the rate of the molecules evaporating equals the rate going back to a liquid condensation, that's when your equilibrium part builds up. So, Vadim, I see you've got a water bottle there with a cap on it. That has a vapor pressure over it, all right? And it's many of you in here, Vadim, you're just the first person I saw. All of those, we could actually put like a type of barometer in there, all right, and measure some kind of vapor pressure. It would be in millibar or millimeters of mercury, something like that. And there's some interesting things that happen from the vapor pressure.
In a closed container, molecules move back and forth between the liquid and gas phases. If the rates of crossover are equivalent, the overall amount of substance in each phase remains constant. The system is said to be in a state of dynamic equilibrium.
And remember that any liquid should have a little bit of vapor pressure over it, all right? So it, again, could be gasoline. I'm using that way too much this morning. It's also water, and it's ethanol, and any kind of liquid you can see, a little bit of vapor pressure happens. And that's important if you go to a concert.
The liquid in the butane lighter is in dynamic equilibrium with the gaseous butane, which has a vapor pressure of about 2.4 atmospheres. When the valve is opened, butane gas escapes from the lighter. The system goes out of equilibrium, and liquid butane rapidly evaporates into the gas phase. When the valve is closed, the system quickly comes to equilibrium again, with the pressure of the butane vapor equal to 2.4 atmospheres.
Now, in the old days at concerts, people used to have their cigarette lighters, woohoo! And now my mom, who's older than me, of course, says, oh, we all use our cell phone flashlights. I'm like, really? But all right, prop that back on. That's just something I got to deal with psychologically. Anyway, you use a cigarette lighter for concerts. Then anyway, the cigarette lighter is actually an example of how this vapor pressure thing works. Now, inside you have butane. And butane, which is one of the alkanes, is actually a liquid at room temperature. But you have to pressurize it. It wants to turn into a gas really easy. So you're inside this little cigarette lighter, you actually have a pretty strong pressure. They said it was 2.4 atmospheres. So that's 2.4 times the pressure at the sea level, which is kind of cool. Anyway, when you're ready to have the concert go, you flip the little thing, it makes a spark, and the butane coming out, which is an alkane, good for fuels, makes a fire. All right, so you have the little light and stuff like that, you can do it. We use this a bunch of times, and after a while then, the butane begins to break down. You have to build up that vapor pressure of butane inside there. If you don't have any vapor, then it can't escape and stuff. So after a while, it runs out, but sometimes, if you let it sit for a few minutes and stuff, and you try it again, you will get a little bit more stuff, because the liquid inside here has built up its vapor pressure and stuff. So, woohoo, cigarette lighters and vapor pressure. Anyway, it's kind of cool to know how things work around this. And, yeah. The alkanes, again, are basically just really great fuels. So we use mostly methane for natural gas here when we use flames, and propane for barbecues, and butane for cigarette lighters.
As heat is added to a beaker of water, the vapor pressure of the water increases, thereby increasing the rate of evaporation. If enough heat is added, the vapor pressure of the water equals the atmospheric pressure. At this point, large bubbles of vapor begin to form in the liquid, and the liquid boils.
Boiling is nothing more than when the vapor pressure gets so great, it pushes back on the atmospheric pressure. So all around us, all the time on the Earth, molecules are pushing down on us. That's the atmospheric pressure. But if the liquid keeps making more and more vapor pressure, and this happens when the temperature increases, eventually the vapor pressure, which is what this blue curve is, equals the atmospheric pressure. And that is truly what boiling is. Boiling is when the vapor pressure of the liquid equals the atmospheric pressure around it. So normally, atmospheric pressure is about one atmosphere. And last week in lab, we measured that with a little blue box barometer. It was right around one. All right, some of you had a little more than one, some of you a little less, but it was about one atmosphere. When the vapor pressure of the water gets to that atmospheric pressure, that's when you start to see the boiling. You start to see the bubbles form and stuff like that. So we're going to start defining a normal boiling point. And a normal boiling point doesn't mean there's an abnormal version or something, but it means that a normal boiling point is when you have a vapor pressure equal to one atmosphere. We're going to see that we can make water boil at temperatures less than 100 degrees. We're going to change the pressure on it here in a little bit. So a normal boiling point means that you have one atmosphere of external pressure, and that's when you can get your liquid to boil.
Forget her, I can cook. There we go, mac and cheese. Boil water. What am I, a chemist?
Okay, American Dad, a really cheesy show, but I just... that really cracked me up when I saw it. So boiling water is hopefully something that you can do without being a chemist, but anyway, Anyway, let's move on from that.
In the flask is water heated to about 55 degrees Celsius, well below water's normal boiling point. We use a device to evacuate the air from the flask. The water boils, though its temperature remains at around 55 degrees.
One time, a family member saw water boiling in an experiment like this at less than 100 degrees Celsius, 212 Fahrenheit. And anyway, and they thought, oh man, this person must be like magic. And I'm like, So I had to get into vapor pressure discussion. But anyway, let's say that you want your water to boil less than 100 degrees Celsius. And why you might want to do that, if you made a compound, for example, and the compound breaks down at 80 degrees Celsius, you don't want to boil off the water because it doesn't boil until 100 degrees. So what you can do is use this kind of apparatus. This is called a Schlenk line. All you need to know is that it takes a lot of the atmospheric pressure out. So it makes like a partial vacuum inside here. If you lower the external pressure, that vapor pressure curve, as long as you get the external pressure to the temperature you want on that vapor pressure curve, you can make the water boil. So I've seen water boil at like 40 degrees Celsius because it was a pretty good vacuum inside there. And again, if you want to get that water off, no problem. Another application of this, if you go to like Denver, the Mile High City, all right, water boils easier because the atmospheric pressure is less. As you go up in elevation, the external pressure gets less. Water will boil easier at higher elevations. Also, if you go to places like Death Valley in California or the Dead Sea, places below sea level, then water actually takes more energy to boil. The external pressure is higher, so you have to add extra energy. So please realize, water boiling at 100 is only for our convenience because most of the time we're at about one atmosphere of pressure. But you can make that water boil at different temperatures if you play with the pressure. And there's some cool things you can do with that.
Heating the liquid water converts it to a gas, which pushes molecules of air out of the container. The inverted can traps the gaseous H2O when we place the can in cold water. The temperature change converts the gaseous water into liquid water, which occupies a much smaller volume. The can is crushed by the pressure of the atmosphere.
So in this silly example, they took a can and they put a little bit of water in it, and then they boiled the can with the water in it over a Bunsen burner, all right? And what happens when you do that is that the external pressure is pushed out and the liquid water is turned into a gas, kind of like our molar mass volatile liquid lab last week. So after a few minutes then, inside the can, you only have gaseous water. So what they did then is they took it quickly off the boiling of the hot Bunsen burner, and they put it in cold water, all right? Well, then all of a sudden, all that water in there says, oh man, it's a lot colder. All of the water condenses back to a liquid, and that creates a vacuum inside the can. So all of a sudden, the external pressure, which again is around us all the time, it squishes the can. There's no more atmospheric pressure inside there. So it's pretty dramatic and stuff. It squishes cans and stuff. So anyway, this is kind of a fun thing to show kids, and you can do this at home if you do this over like a burner, but there are some serious implications of this. These are pictures that I had to get from a website, which I don't really care to share with you. Anyway, this is like one of those big tanker trucks that goes up and down on trains, and now it's here out. These things are squished like the can, and so apparently what happens is inside one of these tanker trucks, they had like a type of a fuel, all right, and gasoline and stuff like that usually boils easier than water does. And so apparently it was kind of a warm day, and someone then decided, oh, I'm going to wash this off with cold water. Well, the whole inside was filled with fumes of this other material, and as you cooled it down, all of those gas fumes condensed back to a liquid. Squish! So be careful if you ever have to cool your train cars, because you could definitely see that squish up. Anyway, if you find things like that and you share it with me, I would be honored. But anyway, it's kind of fun. All right, so what we can do now, since we know that, okay, we can play with the boiling temperature and with external pressure, let's now compare several liquids together and see why they have different boiling points. Like, why aren't all liquids the same? So in this graph, which we'll talk about in the next couple slides, diethyl ether, all right, which has an oxygen in the middle of two ethyl groups, is the first one. Ethanol is the second one, which is an ethyl group with an OH on it. And water over here on the far right, as we know, is H2O. Now, which one of these three compounds has the highest molar mass? The diethyl ether, absolutely. The most atoms and stuff like that. Yeah, Gabe, perfect, that's right. Usually with compounds, when you want to predict boiling points, molar mass is a huge part of it, because it's kind of like taking something and throwing it into the air. So normally, if I was to show you, you know, a structure for these three compounds, you would think that diethyl ether would be the hardest one to boil. It has the most mass, and water with the smallest molar mass would be the easiest to boil. But what we're seeing here is the direct opposite. Diethyl ether is the first one to boil. Ethanol is the one in the middle, the kind of green line, and water is the hardest of all. So if it's not molar mass that's affecting these boiling points, what do you think's happening here? Intermolecular bonds, absolutely. We're seeing here a difference between the strengths of the intermolecular forces. What's the name of the intermolecular force that works on diethyl ether? Is it polar? Are there lone pairs on the oxygen, Lewis structures? Yes, good, thank you. That's right, oxygen likes to have the octet, all right? So there's two invisible lone pairs. There's two pieces right there. What would be the bond angle around that oxygen if it's tetrahedral?
109,
thank you. Yeah, right on, bent. That's right, good, that's right, cool. Everybody's waking up, that's good. So this is bent molecular geometry. It's absolutely polar, all right? Everything around the oxygen is not the same, all right? So diethyl ether is definitely dipole-dipole. That would be the name of the intermolecular force. When you have dipole-dipole, you need to look for OH, NH, and FH bonds. Does this structure have any of those? No, right on. The oxygen is connected to carbon. So the oxygen does not have any OH, NH, or FH bonds. This is just a dipole-dipole force. Now, ethanol has an OH bond. That's the dipole-dipole on steroids slash hydrogen bonding force. And it's much stronger than the diethyl ether's dipole-dipole force. So even though ethanol has less mass, less molar mass than diethyl ether, it actually has a higher boiling point. This OH is sticking together better than the dipole-dipoles do. And little water over here has two hydrogen bonding sources. So you can imagine you can have a hydrogen bond here and a hydrogen bond here. This is supercharged hydrogen bonding. Water is one of the strongest of the intermolecular compounds. So it has a boiling point which is even higher. So you can use your understanding of the intermolecular forces to make predictions anyway as to why you're seeing these kind of parts. Now the dotted line right here is one atmosphere of pressure. So the normal boiling point where diethyl ether boils normally, 34.6 Celsius. And ethanol, which is basically drinking alcohol, about 78 degrees Celsius. And water, as you know, is 100 Celsius. So even though the masses are bigger on this side, it's the intermolecular forces which is going to dictate these pieces right here. On this graph, we have pressure on the y-axis and temperature on the x-axis. So these three lines right here are called vapor pressure curves. And it's showing you all the different vapor pressures for the different molecules. And when that vapor pressure gets up to the atmospheric pressure, that's when boiling starts. So these are all these pressure and temperature conditions, and you can see where liquid and vapor are in equilibrium. That's what the red line for diethyl ether is, the green line for ethanol, etc. On all of these, vapor pressure is increasing as temperature increases. All right, so that makes sense. Temperature goes up, the pressure goes up by ideal gas law. You can see it graphically. All of these are increasing up and to the right as temperature is increasing. When that external pressure is equal to the vapor pressure, that's when you have boiling. So the normal boiling points, again, are assuming you're at one atmosphere of pressure. But if you do research in Denver, or you do things in Death Valley, your temperature, your boiling temperatures may be a little bit different. And even here in Gresham, all right, we don't always have one atmosphere of pressure. So the temperatures that water boil will sometimes change by a degree or two, which is kind of interesting. Boiling points of all liquids will change with altitude, all right? So it does make a difference if you're on top of Mount Everest or if you're at Seaside, Oregon. The difference in the elevation can make a difference what's going on. Normal boiling point means one atmosphere of pressure, and one atmosphere is 760 millimeters of mercury. So if you have an external pressure of 760, and that's when you get your water boil, that's what the normal boiling point is. But again, we can move the external pressure up and down using vacuums and pressurized systems. We can make water boil at temperatures other than 100 degrees if we change the pressure. And the intermolecular forces definitely play a factor. So again, this is just summarizing what we talked about. Diethyl ether is polar. The oxygen, though, is connected to carbon. This would be just a normal polarity or dipole-dipole force. But ethanol and water both have hydrogen bonds. Ethanol has one OH, and water has two OH bonds. So water has supercharged hydrogen bonds. That's why we're seeing the differences here in the boiling points of the liquids. So a lot of times when someone's comparing liquids, why they boil differently, most of the time it's due to differences in polarity. Sometimes molar mass too, definitely. But here the intermolecular forces are king. Okay, so let's say that we were thinking only about intermolecular forces. All right, we're not talking about molar mass or anything like that. We want to put these liquids here, and they're all liquids, we'll say, in order of decreasing boiling points. So we're going to have the biggest boiling point first and the smallest boiling point last. So in terms of intermolecular forces, does that mean we want to put the strongest intermolecular force first or the strongest intermolecular force last? First, absolutely. If you want them in decreasing boiling points, the largest boiling point will have the strongest intermolecular force. That'll go first, and the weakest one will go next. So methanol is CH3OH. This is methane, CH4, and hydrogen. Which one of these has the strongest intermolecular force? CH3OH, absolutely. That's got the hydrogen bond on it, the OH, NH, or FH bond. Alcohols like ethanol and methanol will definitely be the strongest of all of them. Right? So that one should be the strongest of the boiling points. Now, between methane and hydrogen, those are both nonpolar compounds. So between methane and hydrogen, which one do you think would have a higher boiling point? Methane, absolutely. Now both of these are nonpolar. Everything around the central atom is the same. But methane will be a little bit higher just because it's got more mass, all right? It's going to take a little bit more energy to get big pizza methane in the air than little tiny lift hydrogen, all right? Hydrogen will be very easy to get into the air. So methanol has the strongest intermolecular force. You put that one first, that's the strongest. And between methane and hydrogen, which are both IDID, the bigger molar mass will go first and the smallest molar mass will go last. Yeah, Nathan?
And that first one's the strongest because it has the OH bond?
That's right, exactly. If you see the OH, that's one of the hydrogen bonds one. And these are what keep our DNA together and all kinds of things. So definitely be on the lookout for OH, also NH and FH, but the OH is the most common. Good question. Other questions? There's a bunch of interesting things you can do with intermolecular forces.
The viscosity of a liquid depends on the strength of its intermolecular forces. Glycerol has relatively strong intermolecular forces and is rather viscous. Its resistance to flow is high. Ethanol, by contrast, has weaker intermolecular forces. It flows easily and has low viscosity.
Viscosity is a big topic, but one of the things that affects how well a liquid flows is the intermolecular force. And in this video, we're comparing ethanol and glycerol. Ethanol has one OH bond, but glycerol has three OH bonds. It's a triol, all right? And so what happens is ethanol and ethanol, they connect, but they don't connect super well, so it flows like normal, like water. Glycerol, on the other hand, is kind of like syrupy, all right? It pours much slower. And again, remembering that viscosity is a whole bunch of different things, one of the big parts is the intermolecular forces. Glycerol has three OH bonds, so it connects to each other easier, or it's harder to break apart, and it flows slower. The weaker the intermolecular force, the easier it flows. If you had liquid methane, it would flow just like nothing. It would flow faster even than ethanol would. There's more to viscosity than this, but I do want to throw this in because I know that when people talk about viscosity in either material science or even sometimes physics classes, the hard thing to figure out is these intermolecular forces. You at least know now the intermolecular forces, woohoo, and so you'll have no problem if you run across it, and if you don't worry about it except for quiz 5. Anyway, liquids. So there's more about liquids which are interesting, which have to do with that vapor pressure, all right? Molecules at the surface of a liquid are a little different than the molecules deep inside. The molecules at the surface are kind of pulled down and left and right by the other molecules around it. Molecules in the middle will affect things 360, all the way around, no net force. But it's these ones on the outside of the liquid which do have some special kind of force. And this leads to what's called surface tension. And it's literally like a type of a force on the surface of the liquid. The surface tension increases as your intermolecular force increases. So usually surface tension is for the high intermolecular forces, hydrogen bonding, sometimes dipole-dipole. Very rarely is it used for induced dipole. Those forces are just too weak. So let me show you some cool video.
A paperclip is placed carefully in water, or rather on it. The metal clip floats because it isn't heavy enough to break the water's surface tension. By adding a small amount of soap, we reduce the water's surface tension. The paperclip sinks.
This surface tension is the quality of a liquid that causes the surface layer of that liquid to behave like an elastic sheet. It's the effect that allows insects to walk on water and water drops to hold together. This cycle happens again and again until the droplet is small enough to be completely absorbed.
These things on the Discovery Channel, these super high fast cameras, but they're actually watching the drops go down, and we just see the drop, you know, whoopee-doo. Here you're actually seeing it's like bouncing, right? And that's the tension of the water, and it's kind of, then it breaks into a smaller one, and that one bounces too and stuff. Ooh, I love it. Anyway, what's really important about this, all right, is that the little insect, the paperclip at the beginning is like the insect in the lower left corner, all right? People talk about, oh yeah, pollution, it's no big deal, Mother Nature takes care of it. No, screw you, because little insects, which are part of our circle of life, man, they can actually hop on the water. And this is part of their life cycle and stuff. You start putting pollution in there, like soap in that glass thing, it breaks the surface tension. And the more little insects then sink down along with the pollution and stuff, it's a bad thing. So surface tension is one of the reasons why you don't want to pump a lot of chemicals into our natural ecosystem. You start breaking that up, you break how the insects go, and it's a bad thing. So surface tension, like I said, usually used for high intermolecular forces, water being the classic example. You can't do the paperclip thing yourself at home. Be very gentle with the paperclip. It takes a few times, at least with my caffeinated hands, but it is kind of a fun thing to see. And use small paperclips too, by the way. So which of these do you think would have the strongest surface tension? All right. Now, surface tension is basically like a way of talking about the intermolecular forces, which one's strongest. And we have here a combination. This one, for example, is an ether. This compound right here is called a thiol, which is nothing you need to know. But one of these five compounds here has, again, a stronger intermolecular force than the other one. Which one is it?
C.
Ethanol, again, has that hydrogen bond. Sulfur doesn't do the same thing with hydrogen as, again, nitrogen, oxygen, and fluorine. Oxygen in the middle of carbons doesn't do it. Sulfur in the middle of carbons, here's another oxygen in the middle of carbons. This is the only one here with hydrogen bonds to it. Another thing which is interesting is you can have what's called a cohesive and an adhesive force. Water is basically a series of silicon-oxygen bonds. And it's kind of hard to see, but imagine this is oxygen-silicon, oxygen-silicon. Glass is essentially a polar compound. And if you place liquids in a glass thing, some of them will kind of try and get away from the glass, and some of them will actually rise up. And again, you probably think I drink like a madman. I don't. But anyway, red wine in a glass us if you've seen it. Over 21, 19 in Canada, don't do this at home, kids, blah, blah, blah. Red wine actually climbs up the side of the glass, which is really cool. And that's a good, you can see the red easier and stuff like that. So anyway, it leads to then what's called a concave meniscus. Now, a concave means that you're making like a little cave in the liquid. That's how I think about it. And concave is when you place a liquid with a polarity similar to glass. So water in glass, red wine in glass, stuff like that. Concave. If you ask me in lab one time, I'll show you we have a mercury barometer down the hall. Mercury has a different kind of intermolecular force than glass. It tries to get away from the glass. It's kind of mad. It's convex. Vex to me sounds mad. So convex means that you're trying to get away from it. If you put gasoline in a glass container, gasoline also has a different kind of intermolecular force. It would do this kind of process too. So some things want to be closer, and some things want to try and get away from each other, basically.
When a piece of paper is dipped in water, the water moves up the paper by capillary action. The attraction of the water to the surface of the solid paper allows the water to rise against the force of gravity.
You place your paper, newspaper, or whatever you're reading in some water. The water tends to kind of climb up the paper. This is called capillary action. Paper is also a series of polar bonds inside it. So things like water then are like, hey, this is kind of cool. And then it makes your paper basically ruin. So anyway, if you see this kind of thing happen, that's capillary action. It happens because things are similar. Now, all of this talking of phase transitions makes a description of energy required really happy. Oh, poor little bunny, and being a vegetarian animal rights person, I apologize on behalf of the poor bunny, but anyway, this bunny is undergoing a phase transition. It's going from the solid to a liquid, probably some of it's gaseous. Oh, that cracks me up when I see it. Anyway, knowing how the energies of these transitions happen becomes important. So there's terms involved with a lot of these pieces. So if we saw earlier how if you go from a liquid to a gas, it's vaporization, but there's also gases going back to liquids, which are called condensation. And those are somewhat familiar to our lexicon. If a solid goes to a liquid, it melts. And if a liquid goes to a solid, it freezes. So the terms on the left-hand side here are pretty common. But on the right-hand side, once in a while, you can have a solid go up to a gas directly. And there are examples of this, like iodine crystals and carbon dioxide. That's called sublimation. Sublimation is a solid going directly to a gas. And we'll talk more about this on Friday too. And you can also have those same gases go back to a solid. That process is called deposition. Now, remembering that physical scientists are always into the energies of these things, all right? There's going to be a certain heat of something to make solids go to liquids. Heat of melting, heat of vaporization would be liquids going to gas, shall we say. But you can also have a heat of sublimation, which would be the solid going to the gas and stuff like that. In Chem 221, in Chapter 5, we also looked at when you have heat transfers but no phase change. This was the Q equals MC delta T stuff. C was the heat capacity. For water, it was a number 4.184. All of these things play into figuring out the energies of these transformations. So just keep these things in the back of your mind. Chemists find them really useful if you want to see how much energy it takes to freeze your water, for example. You can calculate it. Finally, anytime you go solid to liquid or liquid to gas or solid to gas, those are always endothermic because you have to break intermolecular forces. But if you go gas to liquid and liquid to solid, or gases directly to solid, those are always going to be exothermic, and that will help you when you calculate these things. Now, each one of those vaporization, sublimation, freezing, etc., has a delta H associated with it. Delta H of vaporization is what we'll focus on mostly. That's the liquid going to a vapor, or liquid going to a gas. And here are some values of water, H, sulfur dioxide, etc. Notice how as the intermolecular force increases, the delta H value also increases. Water has the strongest intermolecular force. It has the largest heat of vaporization. Xenon has the weakest. You can also have, though, a heat of fusion, which is when a solid goes to a liquid, for example. Those things can be calculated as well. One more thing before I let you go. All of these values are for one direction, liquid going to gas or vapor. If you wanted to go from a gas back to a liquid, what would you do with the sign of delta H? Negative, right, flip it, that's right. Well done, yeah, I gotta remember. Yeah, delta H is positive in one direction and it will be negative in the other direction. All right, good place to stop. You guys rock, have a good day, I'll see you.